Blog Talk Radio.
Our guest at 8:30, we have Ellen Brown. Ellen Brown is the author of The Web of Debt. Ellen Hodgson Brown, the author of The Web of Debt. She developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. And in The Web of Debt, her latest book, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the money trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we, the people, can get it back. So she's going to talk about that.
Yeah, the fascinating thing about her, too, is that she developed an interest in developing the world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya and Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
And she returned to practice law. She was asked to join a legal team that was a popular Tijuana, they were defending a popular Tijuana healer and an innovative cancer therapist who was targeted for the chemotherapy and by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced her book Forbidden Medicine with traces of
the suppression of natural health
right.
treatments to the same corrupting influences that have captured the money system. Brown's 11 books, including the bestseller Nature's Pharmacy, co-authored with Dr. Lynn Walker, which has sold 285,000 copies. So those are her books?
Yeah, those are all her books.
All kinds of interesting things.
Yeah, you can check her website out. Go to Ellen Brown, and you'll see it there. And
she's at gmail.com.
Yeah, right here I wanted to do this one.
And also, while Leo is doing that, I wanted you to know that besides, he has this. Okay.
Yeah.
Besides Ellen Brown, at 9 o'clock we have In the Ring with Woody, and Woody will be on the show.
Right.
And then at 9:30 it'll be our regular time for John Brennan, who's going to discuss environmental issues.
Yeah.
In chemtrails.
Yeah. So we got a good show set up for you tonight. Well, one of the articles that I wanted to read that caught my attention, all right, and Ellen has been pushing she's the chairman of the Public Banking Institute, and she's been pushing this for quite some time, especially with Web of Debt, on how to create public banks, state banks, state-owned banks. And she has an article that she posted on March 29th, and it was called Why the Japanese Government Can Afford to Rebuild It. And it owns the largest depository bank in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that. So I thought it was fascinating to read this because she shows how the Japanese can actually might be able to afford to get out of the nightmare they're in now.
The Japanese Post Bank is now the largest holder of personal savings in the world, making it the world's largest credit engine. Most money today originates as bank loans and deposits of the magic pool from which this credit money is generated. Japan Post is not only the world's largest depository bank, but it's the largest publicly owned bank. By 2007, it was also the largest employer in Japan and the holder of one-fifth of the national debt in the form of government bonds, as noted by Joe Wiesenthal, writing in Business Insider in February 2010. Because Japan's enormous public debt is largely held by its own citizens, the country doesn't have to worry about foreign investors losing confidence. If there's going to be a run on government debt, it will have to be the result of its own citizens not wanting to fund it anymore. And since many Japanese fund the government via accounts held at the Japan Post Bank, which in turn buys government debt, that institution would be the conduit for a shift to occur. That could explain why Japan Post has been the battleground of warring political factions for over a decade. The Japanese postal savings system dates back to 1875, but in 2001, Japan Post was formed into an independent public corporation, the first step in privatizing it and selling it off to investors. When newly elected Prime Minister Hirochiro Koizumi tried to push through the restructuring, however, he met with fierce resistance. In 2004, Koizumi shuffled his cabinet, appointing reform-minded people as new ministers and created a new position for Postal Privatization Minister, appointing Hizino Takenaka to the post. In March 2006, Anthony Raleigh wrote in Bloomberg, "By privatizing Japan Post, Koizumi aims to break the stranglehold that politicians and bureaucrats have long exercised over the allocation of financial resources in Japan and to inject fresh competition into the country's financial services industry. His plan will also create a potentially mouth-watering target for domestic and international investors. Japan Post Savings Bank and insurance arm boasts combined assets of more than 380 trillion yen.
$3.2 trillion. The $3 trillion asset pool is mouth-watering indeed. 2007 reorganized the Postal Savings Division and separated from the post office's other arms, turning Japan Post into a proper bank, according to an October article in The Economist. The newly created Japan Post will be free to concentrate on banking, and its new status will enable it to diversify into fresh ideas of business such as mortgage lending and credit cards. To some degree, this diversification will also be forced upon the new bank. Some of the special treatments afforded to its predecessor will be revoked, obliging Japan's post bank to invest more adventurously in order to retain depositors and ultimately to attract investors once it lists on the stock market. And the article goes on. I urge you to read it. Well, it's not that much longer. That was the plan. The Japan Post has been investing more adventurously, but it hasn't yet given up its government privileges. New financial service minister has put a brake on the privatization process. The bank's shares have not been sold. And meanwhile, the Consolidated Post Bank has grown to enormous size, passing up Citicorp as the world's largest financial institution, and has been branching into new areas, alarming competitors. In March 2007, an article in USA Today warned the government-nurtured colossus could leverage its size to crush rivals, foreign and domestic.
Before the March 2011 tsunami, that is what appeared to be doing. But now there is talk of reverting to the not neoliberal model, selling off public assets to find the funds to rebuild. Christian Carley commented in March 19th article in a Foreign Affairs published by the Council on Foreign Relations. As horrible as it is, the devastation of the earthquake presents Japan and its political class with a chance to push through the many reforms that the Democratic Party of Japan has long promised and the country so desperately needs. In other words, a chance for investors to finally get their hands on Japan's prized publicly owned bank and the massive deposit base that has so far protected the economy from the attacks of foreign financial predators. The Japanese government can afford its enormous debt because the interest it pays is extremely low. For the private economy, public debt is money. A large public debt owed to the Japanese people means Japanese industries have the money to rebuild. But if Japan Post is sold off to large private investors, interest rates are liable to rise, plunging the government into the debt trap it has so far largely escaped. The Japanese people have strong community values, however, and they are not likely to submit quietly to domination by foreigners. They generally like their government because they feel it is serving their interests. Hopefully, the Japanese government will have the foresight and the fortitude to hang on to its colossus, publicly owned bank and use it to leverage its people's savings into the credit needed to rebuild its ravaged infrastructure, avoiding a crippling debt to foreign interests.
So that's on. You can read that article on Web of Debt.
That would be nice for us.
What's that?
We could have a federal a bank.
Oh, I think it should be. It makes so much sense to me, you know.
The real estate banks, I mean,
but it's amazing. As a skeptic says, our country with a national debt that was over 200% of GDP could be strong and wealthy, right?
And that's how.
I mean, and they're worried about our GDP. In a CIA fact book list of debt, the GDP ratios of 132 countries in 2010, Japan was at the top of the list, 226, passing up Zimbabwe, and rigging in at 149%. Greece and Iceland and so on, we're all over. So the answer, folks, is public banking.
Yeah.
That's the answer. That's the way to get it done. And, wow. Anyway, so I wanted to go to another one here. And I'm going to head right over here to another.
Now, she just wrote that article?
Yeah, that was recently. That was most recent. And, let's see.
Pop can cause heavy nuclear type explosions.
Last week, John had mentioned last week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he brought up the woman seismologist or whatever she might have been. But she was saying that she believed that HAARP, that the Japanese tsunami
was caused by
HAARP.
Yep.
Okay. This is only 2 minutes long.
Let's see what they say here.
UN report, HAARP can cause heavy nuclear type explosion. So it's just a few minutes long.
PM Central Standard Time on Sunday, April 3rd, 2011. And I'm back in action, so I just wanted to show you guys something here that's truly amazing. And this was filed in the UN General Assembly, and it was a special committee on decolonization. Okay? Right? I mean, what? So let's just go ahead and search something here really quick. Here it is. HAARP. Adelia Centeno Rodriguez said her organization had spoken last year on the United States strategy to authorize nuclear weapons production facility in Puerto Rico in violation of the Treaty on the Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons. She explained that Arecibo was home to the Arecibo National Astronomy and Ionospheric Center, the NAIC, which was used as an, quote, ionospheric heater, an array of antenna which are used for heating the uppermost part of the atmosphere. Arecibo was also mentioned as a test site for the high-frequency active auroral research program in a patent filed by an individual in the United States to conduct experiments related to ionospheric manipulation. HAARP could function as an anti-missile and anti-aircraft defense system, permit interception and disruption of communications, disruption of weather, and submarine and subterranean communications, among other things. Now, this is it right here, guys. This is crazy. Listen to this. The HAARP patent papers also stated that the invention could simulate and perform the same function as performed by the detonation of a heavy-type nuclear device. All right, and the report goes on and on and on, and I'm not going to read you the whole thing. This covers what I cover, and that's why I'm bringing this to you. HAARP can be used to cause a quote-unquote heavy-type nuclear device explosion. And I'm going to put that out there right now. We're going to be delving into where they have tested this before and where we may think they may have used it recently. Till then, folks, much love, and I'm going to do an earthquake update next. We've had a very busy day with earthquakes. Cheers.
You can check that out on YouTube, and it's called UN Report HARP.
Can cause heavy nuclear type explosion.
All right.
I'm not sure who that man was that was talking.
Me neither. We can mention this too, but the merciless green austerity system is on the agenda for the UN's 2012 Earth Summit, which is part of the Agenda 21. The United Nations flag with a grid over the globe is an important clue for those who monitor world affairs. They are tightening their grip on the Earth and laying out their control grid piece by piece. The previous Earth Summit in 1993 produced an insidious action plan entitled Agenda 21.
The plan was carried out and allowed the United Nations to acquire and control resources from around the globe and coerce local, state, and federal governments to do their bidding for the sake of the Earth. In 2012, they meet again in Rio, but the media campaign has already kicked off. Initial recommendations have been released by participating working groups, and they are comprehensive enough to give eco-zealots wet dreams.
I don't read more.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, go ahead. You can go. That much on
this
page, but let's
take a look. For the sake of the Earth.
Go down.
Okay.
The so-called green economy is a nightmare and has been for any nation who has tried to implement it. They intend to apply a progressive tax to carbon emission and raise the cost of food so that consumers know exactly the ecological damage done according to their own flawed data. This will cripple economies and leave the people with barely enough food to eat and money in their pockets. The idea that the United Nations decides how much food and necessities are produced so we can stay in line with Malthusian scarcity models is madness and something we cannot allow to happen anywhere.
I think it's important, though, just to note, these what green economy means.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it says in this report, it states that... we are currently transitioning from a world of plenty into one with which the planet resources have been compromised in their ability to sustain our routines. We are also in a world of global economic and social multi-level governance. What is a green economy? A green economy ensures fair use of ecological resources and sinks at regenerational and bioassimilation rates. Building such an economy entails the following components.
Number one, full cost pricing. Incorporate ecological degradation into the cost of goods and services with compensation for the poor.
Waste, food design, product production to...
Waste equals food design production.
To reuse all pre- and post-consumer waste as industrial or biological inputs.
Number three, sustainable ethic. Foster cultures that recognize ecological scarcity and inspire consumers and producers to desire only what is most necessary and ecologically sustainable.
Progressive green taxes. Tax resource and sink use instead of income.
Number five,
tax resource and sink use instead of income.
And sink use instead of income. Number five, wealth equals environmental health. Create measures of value that preserve the intrinsic worth of nature. Beyond Rio Plus 20 governance for a green economy.
Yeah, there is a... You want to read that part? Or?
No, that's... I would go down to here. The United Nations is not...
The United Nations is not satisfied with their current influence and control over governmental affairs. They have big plans, plans such as the creation of a World Environment Organization, International Environment Court, and Global Parliament for the Environment. These organizations would wield as much power as the IMF and the WTO and bring about punishments for victimless crimes.
Imagine having to go to court because you don't recycle. The green police infrastructure will be created piecemeal and under the radar. Being a global warming denier could have real repercussions. The really sad fact is that they are using our taxpayer money to create a weapon against us.
In the United States initiated a civilian conservation corps in 1933 as a work relief program wherein unemployed youth were enlisted to implement a natural resource conservation program. Participants planted 3 billion trees, constructed more than 80 state parks, and built infrastructure to make public lands accessible. The program also built awareness and appreciation of American natural beauty and resources among populations.
That's what was. That's
right.
Not what's going to be.
No. But a similar program in which youth served for a year as stewards of the land could arise with countries around the world. Citizens would work as public servants, as water treatment plants, waste disposal sites, farms, environmental remediation areas, and urban transportation centers. This would give youth a sense of contemporary ecological challenge and enlist them in helping countries meet their provisioning needs in a sustainable fashion. While civilian corps systems have historically been national in scope, there is reason to expand them beyond national boundaries. A transitional regional or even global. This is complete and total international communism.
Uh-huh.
This is what they're talking about. And this is beyond Rio 20 Governance for a Green Economy, which is meeting again.
The new green austerity beast doesn't provide many jobs, as the goal is to scale down economies. But they have a purpose for those who are enjoying their unemployment or welfare benefits. This is something that Obama proposed when he ran for president. In order for the new green economy to appear legit, they must find eco-zealots to spread the gospel, and they want your children. You can't find a school in this country that is not talking about global warming and the environment. This lays the foundation for the new religion so you don't have any misgivings while living in a sustainable shanty town.
I've never seen any document that came out of the Club of Rome, UN, or any non-governmental organization that clearly defines what sustainable living is. Our local government officials doesn't know what it really means either, but will remove 30% of your town's parking space and eventually try to force you on a sustainable public transportation. As the gas prices go up and the economy slides it down, you are not able to own a car, let alone able to drive it. The EU wants to ban all motor vehicles that run on gas. As electric and gas prices spike, our wallets get thinner and thinner, our options are becoming fewer. Our freedoms are vanishing before our eyes, and most people don't have time to notice the change as people are busy surviving. Sustainability means barely living, barely able to sustain life. And that gap between first world nations and third is narrowing faster than you'll ever know. So much money goes into the appearance of improving the third world, but instead of helping them up, they are pushing us down, so we meet at the bottom.
I see that.
Yeah,
the UN wants to govern your economy, your hopes, dreams, values, and principles. Sustainable development is a means to an end, the end of sovereignty and the end of independence. Their flag tells it all. They have laid down the grid upon the world, and the wreath means that they declare themselves to be the supreme rulers like Julius Caesar. There will be more information on the 2012 Earth Summit in the near future. We have no choice but to be out in front on this and shame them with their own words.
Yep. And the last note on that was they said the absence of global solidarity among sovereign states undermines the possibility of a strong global environmental ethic, and thus efforts toward creating a global green economy, states pursue their national interests, often devoid of global concern. A country's flag, its patriotic symbol, thus serves as a powerful instrument for cultivating global consciousness and building momentum for a green world economy. By sewing a small image of the globe in the corner of their existing flags, countries could demonstrate the solidarity with the ecological imperative that national concerns dovetail with global ones. They want you to deface your flag.
Yeah.
Over this as well.
Okay.
Oh, man, I'll tell you, it's getting sick. And we got about five more minutes before our guest, so hopefully we'll call us. And let's see where we can go with this.
No, we've already read that. There's higher levels of food irradiation that they're doing
that
all over the world. All over the world. We talked about that last week and the week before.
And I
just love this. There's not much on the second day. Professional liar wants to lie for four more years. That's Obama. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. And it says, ha, ha, ha. It's a picture of Obama in back of him. Interesting, folks. He has Joe Lieberman laughing and Bill Clinton and Bush, Hillary Clinton, Cheney, Newt Gingrich,
Rumsfeld, Cheney.
Condoleezza Rice.
Condoleezza Rice, Biden.
Yeah.
And what's his head there?
The guy went to Chicago, chief of staff.
And Greenspan in the back.
Ron Emanuel.
Rahm Emanuel.
I wanted to call him Ram.
President of Chicago. This is BBC News.
No. It's not a very good article.
Yeah. I don't care about him.
But just to let you know that, you know, he belongs to the same club.
I think I'm going to vote for Trump. Can you make my mind think I'm better, doctor, so I will be?
That's for giving people placebos. This is pretty interesting. In 1998, Ron Paul accused the CIA, Bush Sr., and the Democrats of drug trafficking, and they have that on tape.
You want to listen to that one?
I did. Maybe the folks would like to listen to that.
I think so.
Let's talk about what could be the most explosive issue of this campaign if the mass media would get a hold of it and do something about it, but they're covering it up. And that is you were talking about the government involvement in drugs. There have been government investigations, there have been private investigations, and we've interviewed a lot of people, ex-CIA people, who have talked about the CIA involvement in drug operations for many decades. It's public knowledge, though once again the media are not saying anything about it, that Oliver North and his people involved with the Contras have been running drug operations, cocaine primarily, bringing it back into the United States. And there are other investigations which show that George Bush's office, Donald Gregg particularly, and the people he was working with, have been supervising an enormous drug operation, which once again was sending illegal arms or down to the Contras and elsewhere, and bringing cocaine and other types of drugs back into the United States. But neither the Democrats aren't talking about this now. Are the libertarians talking about this, and do they put this into the framework of the drug law situation that you're talking about?
We talk about a whole lot. Of course, we always have the trouble of getting the attention that we think it deserves. There have been a few Democrats who have talked about it. Senator Kerry's office has done some work.
He's done
on
a lot of the investigation.
Right.
I'm going to cool that. If you want to go to that, 1988, Ron Paul.
Accuses the CIA, Bush Sr., and the Democrats of drug trafficking.
Right.
But here's one that's interesting. No degree and little experience, big payoff. Just in his mid-20s, Brian DeShane has no college degree, very little management experience, and two drunken driving convictions. Yet he has landed an $81,500 per year job in Governor Scott Walker's administration, overseeing environmental and regulatory matters and dozens of employees at the Department of Commerce. Even while Walker says the state is broke and public employees are overpaid, DeShane already has earned a promotion and a 26% pay raise in just 2 months with the state. How did DeShane score his plum assignment with the Walker team? It's all in the family. Let's see. That's disgusting.
This is Walker of Wisconsin who's trying to cut everybody's pay and no bargaining.
And lay off union workers.
Okay, I've been DeShane.
His father, Jerry DeShane, executive vice president and longtime lobbyist for the Madison-based Wisconsin Builders Association, which bet big on Walker during the last governor's race. The group's political action committee gave $29,000 to Walker and his running mate, Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish, last year, making it one of the big top five PAC donors to the governor's successful campaign. Even more impressive, members of the trade group funneled more than $92,000 through its conduit to Walker's campaign over the past 2 years.
Total donation, $121,652. That's big-time backing from the home builders. The young DeShane didn't respond to questions about his job, but his father said he doesn't think his group financial support of the financial Republicans, first-term Republican, helped his son in this job search.
Yeah, right.
We got the position himself, said Jerry DeShane, who returned to the trade group in September after a hiatus during which he worked as an independent lobbyist for many groups, including the Builders Association. I didn't get it for him. One Walker critic isn't buying it. State Senator Rep. Husley said DeShane's appointment is another case of new administration using state jobs to repay various industries. Husley said he was unimpressed with younger DeShane's resume, including his lack of environmental management experience. It doesn't look like he's even ever had a real job.
The Madison Democrats said.
Husley noted that the recently approved law that made collective bargaining changes converts 37 top agency attorneys, communication officials, and legislative liaisons from civil service positions to jobs appointed by the governor. This is an example of the quality of candidates you're going to get, said Husley, owner of the consulting firm Better Environmental Services. Okay, and we have Ellen on the line. And good evening, Ellen.
Hi, Leo. Great to talk to you.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
I'm good.
It's nice to have you back on our show. It's Lila speaking.
Oh, hi, Lila. Thanks.
So
we just read your new article that you posted on Japan and how Japan really has the ability to bail itself out of this huge problem that it has, but also because it has a huge public bank, it's now, because of its precarious position, very vulnerable to foreign predators.
So yeah, that was a great article. So do you think they will sell off, or do you think they'll try to hold on?
Well, I hope they hold on. I think they should hold on. And so that was one reason I wanted to write about it and point out that whole situation, because there's so much pressure for everybody to privatize. It's part of the World Trade Organization rules. And I know in Germany they had a strong public banking tradition, and they wound up, there was a lot of pressure from the EU to give up being underwritten by the government, because supposedly it wasn't fair. You know, it was unfair competition to the other banks that they weren't also supported by the government. But if you are the government and it's your own bank, I mean, that's the whole point of a government bank. It's more secure. It can't go down. It's got the deep pocket of the state, and it's run for the public interest. I mean, there's nobody that's siphoning profits out of it, making it unsustainable.
In that way, you couldn't be beholden to the infrastructure of the European Union, could you?
Yeah.
Right.
You know what I found fascinating, in a way, was that what they're doing, okay, what Japan is doing now, mm-hmm. Hitler did during the 30s and 40s when he had, I mean, one of the main reasons for World War II was that the bankers, okay, were ticked off at the Nazis because the Nazis didn't need the bankers, all right? They had their own
exactly.
Their own money, and they had their own state bank, basically.
Well,
that's how they became so wealthy. And what they also did was they used, instead of using dollars, what they did is use labor credits, they called it, all right? And mm-hmm. it was fascinating how that fascist economy developed, but at the same time, it wasn't so much what they did is they used they did away with the dollar because they didn't have any money. They were completely
they were
bankrupt, broke country, And so they nobody would take their currency. And what they did is they formed this labor credit. So everything was it was a fiat currency basically of their own, but it was based on so much labor, you know, that was done, and it was all processed through the government. And of course, what happened was is then they decided, well, gee, they became quite wealthy and they had a lot of stuff going on. But they said, well, if we don't have to pay anybody, all that money goes to us. So they decided to enslave the Jews and enslave all these other groups to work for nothing. But so it became a repressive society. But honestly, we're kind of doing that in this society because they got the same problem with a lot of the prisoners, a lot of the prisons. They're making prisoners work for slave labor. But I'm not getting off the subject, but I'm just saying that in Japan, they're holding on to these huge assets. Do you think they have enough to get themselves out of this mess that they're in now?
I do. Well, obviously they're in a horrible situation, and nobody you wouldn't wish that on anyone. But if anybody is in a position to pull themselves out of it, they are. They've got the largest the highest GDP to debt to GDP ratio of any country, but that's actually good the way they do it. It's like the Germans, like you were saying, they've actually got a totally different financial model. And if you wanted to get conspiratorial about it, our bankers have been after them for a long time. Like in 1988, when Japan was they were the largest creditors in the world. 8 out of 10 of the largest banks were Japanese banks in the 1980s. And then the Bank for International Settlements came along and raised the capital requirement from 6% to 8%, a mere 2%. But because the Japanese banks weren't as heavily capitalized as other banks, that brought them to their knees, and the banks were essentially bankrupt, and the economy fell. But so the stock market dropped in half, and of course housing dropped in half. And despite all that, they pulled themselves back up with this same system where, because they own the bank, Japan Post Bank is their largest bank, and it's actually the largest commercial bank in the world now, the largest depository bank, and the largest publicly owned bank. So it's a threat to the other banks, and the Bank of Japan is owned by the government as well. So the Bank of Japan is doing quantitative easing. Like right now, they're doing an issue of money to pay workers and materials to do infrastructure to rebuild, which is what they should be doing. But what other countries have been forced to do is what Naomi Klein wrote about disaster capitalism. When some big disaster hits, depending on how conspiratorial you want to get, but either it hits naturally or it hits because it was imposed, then the country is forced to borrow from the IMF, and then that puts them in this whole austerity cycle, and then they become essentially debt peons, debt slaves to the banking system. And Japan has escaped all that because they own the Bank of Japan, they own Japan Post Bank, and they do what any bank does, which is use their deposit base, which is huge, to leverage into loans, into more credit, which they then use to rebuild.
Well, we tried to.
So they don't have a Federal Reserve system then.
No.
Oh, they do.
No.
Well, they have the Bank of Japan, but they actually literally own the Bank of Japan, unlike our Federal Reserve, which they call it public-private, but all 12 Federal Reserve banks are owned privately by the banks in those districts. There's not one share of stock that's owned by the government, whereas Japan Post is 100% owned by the government, even though technically it's supposed to get privatized, and so is the Bank of Japan.
Do you think they'll do that now, or do you think they'll help people to hold on? Do you think they'll be able to hold
on? I didn't hear. Sorry.
Do you think they will be able to hold on based on their history?
Rather than be privatized.
Rather than
be
privatized, do you think they will be?
I think they will, yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I don't know, but just from their character, it seems to me that they seem to be more inclined to go down with the ship than to give up their sovereignty.
What a great model, though, huh? That it's a system that works so flexibly and so for the people.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, they provide education, health care, and they provide for old age. So people, I've heard this criticism that, well, the savers put their money in the post bank and they get almost no interest on that money, and they're not really allowed to make money in the stock market. But they don't need to make money because the government actually provides for old age, unlike here where half the people may have their money in the stock market and may have enough, you know, for old age, but half the population is facing homelessness when they get to be old. They don't have anything, and they don't have anything to fall back on. So the Japanese system, that's the reason they're so heavily in debt, is that debt represents what they have done for their people in the way of social services that aren't immediately profitable in terms of, you know, paying money into the government.
Have you been able to see this new Republican budget that has just been out on the news today? They want to get $6 trillion over the next 5 years or something, or 10 years, out of the budget, and it sounds totally, totally devastating to.
It's draconian.
Yeah,
it really is.
We have an idiot here who's just a Democrat who thinks that taxing the poor. Now he's taxing haircuts. He's taxing purchases on clothing under $50. He's taxing
everything you can think of.
Taxis and bus fares and anything that's possibly taxable. All right, this guy intends to do. Instead of raising the tax rate on
the wealthy,
on Connecticut's wealthy, I mean we're dealing with billionaires up here. Okay, we're paying no taxes, all right? But he refuses to raise that. I mean, instead he raises the sales tax, and he raises this, and he raises that.
The gas tax. We have the second highest gas tax in the country.
Right.
Electric rates. We
have the second highest in the country. Our infrastructure sucks. Everything in the state, and yet he's continually.
Putting the burden on the poor and
the
middle class.
Yeah. And,
it's like class warfare in the state.
Right.
I think it is intentional class warfare, but still there's a problem with the model. We can't get the rich to give up. They're in control, and they're not going to give up their money. So they're taking it away from the poor. But we don't need to really take it away from anyone. What we need is more money in the system. Everybody says that would be inflationary, but it's not. We're lacking money. There's been a credit crisis, and that's what propelled this whole cycle that we're in now. So if you put the credit back, you can pay for. We've got all these people out of work. If you got the people, you got the materials, and all you're lacking is the money, just print the money or just create it as credit on your own bank, on, you know, an account in your own bank, issue it as credit. Australia did that in the 19, when they first set up the Commonwealth Bank of Australia in 1912. They had just dealt with this huge depression. The 1890s was a huge depression. And the banking system had collapsed, and they realized they couldn't trust the private banks anymore. So they set up a publicly owned bank, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. But fortunately, it was run by bankers, and they knew how banking worked. And so, the other bankers said, well, you're going to need some of our capital. You know, you're going to need to borrow from us to get your capital to get started. And the man in charge, he was a banker, but he sort of turned. He realized that he had this precious asset just delivered to him, the ability to create a bank in the public interest. And so he said, I'm not going to need any capital. I'm going to issue the credit of the people, which is what he did, and did amazing things, built, seaways and roadways and shipping lines. And then they funded World War I just with that bank before it even had the power, before it was actually the central bank. So before it had the power to literally create the nation's money, you know, the actual money of the nation. They were just issuing the credit of the nation, issuing it on their books as credit, the way all banks do. So all we
have to do is
copy the banks.
Yes, Ellen, you're the one that's going to have to set up a bank for the people.
We're trying.
We now have nine states with state bank bills pending, which is great. That's amazing to me. They just keep popping out of the woodwork, yeah.
I do hope we have some hope of those bills passing.
You know, I enjoyed the other article you had on Wisconsin, saying that they had $67 billion, I guess that's in pension funds or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, if they use that as assets, you know, for that bank, they could lend nine or ten times that amount out, and
12 times. Technically, if they used it for the 12 and a half times, if they used it for their capital base, of course, you'd never pry that much loose out of the pension fund. But it's not like you're spending it. All you're doing is moving it over from its current investment into another investment. And you can't do worse than, I live in California, you can't do worse than our pension fund did here. CalPERS lost, I've forgotten, they lost 50% 1 year and 30% the next year, something like that. A huge amount of money.
My God. Oh, that's terrible.
I may have exaggerated that. Maybe it was 30 and, I guess it was 30 and 25. I think it came out to, anyway, they lost a huge amount of money. Like,
can you tell me?
It was $360 billion and now it's $200 billion.
Oh, boy. That's awful.
Can you tell me how they're getting interested? Or what's going on? How are these states becoming interested? And what's being said to them, and how are they being lobbied?
For state banks?
We've actually started a public banking institute, but we can't take credit for all that because I'll give you the website though for anybody who's interested, because we've got all the data on it. publicbankinginstitute.org.
I've been there, and I've actually asked to coordinate some of the efforts here in our state. But the thing that I'm curious about is I'm curious to find out how what they're presenting and how they're lobbying and who are they talking to? Are they talking to the governors and the legislatures? Who are they? How are they getting these results? I mean, the people that in your institute that are. You know, obviously there's nine states now, you said, that are...
So they find someone who's interested in that person, that legislator creates the bill.
Yeah, I mean, what are they presenting?
Yeah.
What kind of information?
They're modeling the bill. They're all modeled after the Bank of North Dakota, which is currently the only state-owned bank. But it's doing so well. It's like so dramatic. When I first started writing on this, it was more than 2 years ago, and at that time, there were four states that were able to meet their budgets. And one of them was North Dakota, and I thought, that's interesting. I mean, it's just a coincidence. And then there were three, and then there were two, and then there was one, and it was North Dakota. And I was kind of cheering watching the thing go up. So it's just remarkable. I mean, there's something different about North Dakota. People say, well, they've got oil, or, you know, they can think they didn't get into the housing bubble. Well, they didn't, for a good reason. The reason all the other states got into the housing crisis was that they got into this whole mortgage-backed security thing where they weren't able to meet their capital requirements without selling off their loans. In other words, because of this capital requirement imposed arbitrarily from outside, from Switzerland, the Bank for International Settlements, which is, you know, the private head of the central banking system. Because of that requirement, the small banks, the local banks, if you have $8, then you can make $100 in loans. That's the way it works. So once you've made your $100 in loans, you can't make any more unless you get rid of that $100 worth of loans. So what they would do is sell the loans off to investors, and then they could make more loans and more loans. They didn't care who they sold to, because they weren't going to be stuck with this loan. That was the idea. They were selling the investors theoretically.
These horrible mortgages, right?
But in North Dakota, they sold it to the Bank of North Dakota. It partnered with the small banks, took the loans off their books. So it served the role of the mortgage-backed securities scam, but it did it responsibly. In other words, they both still had skin in the game. The local bank still had part of it, and the Bank of North Dakota had part of it.
Well, and how are the now that you've got these in there now, but how many of these how many of these nine states are close to instituting a bank, state bank?
There are a couple that think they will do it by maybe the early next year or the end of this year.
What states would those be selling?
The closest is probably Oregon. The problem is that it's not exactly the model that we would It's a, he calls it a virtual bank. It was the treasurer got behind it, and of course that's what you want. You want the treasurer on your side, but the treasurer kind of modified what he was willing to push, and so it's more like a revolving fund where they take the state's money and then relend it. But he is consolidating all the assets, which is a good thing. I mean, states have all this money all over the place in rainy day funds that's just sitting there drawing a teeny bit of interest, basically invested on Wall Street, giving Wall Street all this leverage. And if you bring all that back into a central pool, you can use it yourself. So they're hoping, the people that are working on the bill in Oregon, they're hoping that he'll go one step further. You know, once they try that, the revolving fund thing, and they say, well, but look at all the advantages if we actually leverage this money like a bank does. In other words, create credit on top of our existing money. So they're inching their way forward, but they'll do something. Something will get done probably by the end of the year or next year.
Oh, that's fabulous. I think now, that's just wonderful.
Now, with that program, will it work well, or will it?
Yeah.
Was it? It's not the North Dakota model, so it's not the exact one. But
he was opposed completely to the idea in the beginning, and he's come all the way around to what he calls a virtual bank. So they're hoping to bring him around a little farther. I mean, it really just makes so much sense. Why give up? If you've got all your money right there in one pool, and why give up the potential of leveraging it and look in the liquidity features that a bank gets? Why not go one step farther?
And how are the people of Oregon responding to this? Are they talking about
They have a groundswell of support. They had a hearing recently, and there were people outside the door and watching on TV, I guess. They couldn't fit everybody in the room.
So it sounds like there's a lot of support for it.
Aren't they lucky. That's great. So anybody else pretty close to the North Dakota model?
We just had a conference call today, and there was somebody else, but I'm not sure which state it was. Sorry.
I'm just curious if it was anybody out on the East Coast here.
Yeah, I'm wondering if
I'll find
here,
out, and I can email it to you.
I'd be
interested. I know you said Massachusetts had a bill, but I wondered how far along they are.
I don't actually know the status of. But I know they renewed the bill. It was let lapse the previous year, and they've brought it again, and they've got support for it. So I don't know how far
they've
gotten.
That's great. I wish it would happen here in my own state. How is the progress out there in sunny California?
Well, we have a lot of interest, and there is one legislator who's putting together a bill. But we're kind of going slow, which I think is good. We've learned from all the experience of all these other states that it's politics, you know. So you have to really lay your groundwork. You have to work with the bankers, the local bankers, show them that this is going to help them, not hurt them. Work with the businessmen. In fact, in Oregon and Washington, they did a survey of small businesses to see if they were able to get loans and, you know, if this would serve them. And then they definitely, of course, found that all these small businesses were suffering. They there for them, there's a credit crunch. So they had that data, and they had the backup of the small business and the small bankers. So that was very helpful. So we're trying to do that. And here in California, of course, we're more left-leaning, so there are labor groups that are interested. So we're
I would think so. I'm trying to get the labor groups in Connecticut am I interested in this. It's so difficult to figure out how to approach them with these concepts, because I don't know what kind of material are you giving? What kind of outreach programs are you doing or lobbying programs are you doing to reach these guys and get this material in front of them what's going on?
We have quite a bit of material on that website, publicbankinginstitute.org.
Right.
But I think what I know that is the problem, is that people don't understand the concept. So you can't really walk into a supermarket and do an initiative and say, would you like to sign our initiative for a state bank? They'll say, well, I don't trust the government, or what do we need another bank for? They don't understand what you're talking about. But what everybody seems to understand is that we've given away our money to Wall Street. So we want to bring our money back. And there is this move your money movement where people are bringing back their personal deposits. But obviously the state has a huge amount of deposits and a huge amount of capital, and it's all invested in Wall Street. So, well, not all. They do invest in their local banks too. But see, we're not talking about pulling anything out of the local banks. We're only talking about pulling money out of the Wall Street banks and creating more money. In other words, creating credit. So leveraging that money, what we're doing right now is we're giving that power away to Wall Street, which is then leveraging the money to invest in foreign businesses that are competing with our businesses. You know, they're putting it in China or whatever, and they're taking our labor. So we want to get that money back and invest it in our own labor, put our own people back to work.
I also wanted to ask: is it possible for? I wanted to know if it was possible to get if you have a DVD or some kind of introduction. Movie.
Actually we do. It's not ours. Well, I think we do have some of our own. And if you go to that website, you'll see those too. But there was a Ken McDermott Rowe. There's a man who has a radio program, Ken McDermott Rowe, and he did a little YouTube video which was really great, and it had PowerPoints and charts and stuff. We thought it was really great as a little introductory thing. I've done PowerPoints, but they're, an hour long. they're on the internet. But, yeah.
Okay, we'll take a look for that.
So there are videos, PowerPoints or
on YouTube
of your presentations or other presentations on banking.
Yeah, and if you go to on publicbankinginstitute.org under resources and media, there's a media link, I think, and you can go there.
Okay.
We need them. Okay.
Okay. Well, Ellen, I want to thank you so much for being on with us tonight. I'll be pursuing this more and hopefully talking to you in the near future about it as we start to lobby the state of Connecticut.
That's great. And that'd be great to get something going there.
And thank you very much for all you're doing. I mean, you have the solution to the problem, and it's such really such a simple solution, but so difficult to accomplish.
Yeah,
I know.
I can understand my concern when talking to people about it is breaking through that ice and breaking through that, like you said. Why do I want a state bank? You know, why do I want them to own everything? Why do I want them to have everything? And,
I don't trust politicians. That's another thing. When they say that, you're not putting politicians to run it. That's, in fact, the Bank of North Dakota people themselves said, if you're going to follow our model, the first thing we recommend is don't have politicians run it by bankers. You know,
that's
only
right.
Do reasonable, creditworthy borrowers and loans that are going to work.
Yeah.
Well, we'll remember your words, and hopefully we can get something going here in Connecticut, and we appreciate your being on our show. Thanks very much, Ellen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen.
Yeah.
And have a pleasant evening.
Okay.
Good night.
We got Woody in the ring coming up here for you in just 1 second. Lila, I don't know what's better, my theme music or your introduction.
Very humorous.
Well, thank you. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NFL news, Bonds trial progresses, UConn wins it all, and of course, baseball. Let's get down to it. About 2 weeks after NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell wrote to active players and outlined the league's position in a labor dispute, management council members Mark Murphy and Jerry Richardson have reached out to retired players with a similar letter detailing components of its March 11th offer that could have affected retirees. Murphy and Richardson, Green Bay Packers CEO and Carolina Panthers owner, respectively, are former NFL players. They are short about 7,000 vested veterans due to receive the letter that NFL owners would continue to fund pensions and benefits for retired players during the lockout. We want you to be fully informed and to know the facts, they wrote, disputing NFL Player Association Chief Domori Smith's statement in New York's WFAN radio that owners don't contribute to former players' pensions. They contend that in the last 10 years, NFL owners have contributed $2.7 billion to the funding of benefit plans for current and former players, and that on March 30th, owners paid nearly $180 million to fund benefits for 2010. The NFL and the NFLPA have maintained that improving benefits for retired players who don't have a defined stake in the bargaining process is an important issue during the labor dispute. Also, HGH testing. Commissioner Roger Goodell said Monday that the NFL would demand that human growth hormone testing be included in the next collective bargaining agreement. Goodell spoke at a youth football event in Baltimore and said the league would push forward on the plan as it sought a resolution to the lockout. According to Goodell, the integrity on the NFL is critical. He said that to the Baltimore Sun-Times. We have to make sure what we're doing, everything possible to make and have the best drug program in sports. Making changes to our program is critical. We have done that over the years, and we have to do more, including the inclusion of HGH testing. Goodell's comments came less than 2 weeks after Adolfo Birch, the league's senior vice president of law and labor policy, said the NFL considered it necessary time to insist on HGH testing for its players. HGH testing is one of the more potentially divisive issues between the league and the NFLPA in their labor impasse. The sides are due in federal court in St. Paul on Wednesday for hearing on the players' request to end the lockout. The sides have discussed the HGH testing before. According to Goodell, he said the players are aware of the importance of doing it. The issue the players have with the HGH testing is that there's not a reliable urine test for HGH, that blood has to be drawn. This is just a nice little way for the players to avoid, you know, being tested for HGH. A lot of guys use it. It's known to be the fountain of youth. And they need to use it as long as possible. I mean, you know, if you want to play the game at a high level, you know, a lot of guys use this kind of stuff.
And if they can just keep avoiding, you know, the testing under the guise of, I mean, this is my personal opinion, under the guise of, oh, well, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to have to, you know, give blood, you know, it has to be a urine test, just like the drug test, so on and so forth. I think, you know, they're going to stick to their guns as long as possible, because I think they want to continue to use HGH. I mean, that's just my personal opinion, but it certainly wouldn't surprise me. You know, that's what their reasoning is. And until it, you know, and then maybe, you know, finally when the day comes when they can make a urine test that, you know, that tests for HGH, well, then they'll kind of be back into a corner. But until then, I think they're probably going to stand strong on this. And I would be extremely surprised if the Players Association allows it to go through under the guise of, you know, we're going to draw your blood. I just don't, you know, those guys aren't going for it. I find it very hard to believe that that's going to pass through. That definitely bears watching. What else bears watching? Barry Bonds' trial. Very interesting. Steve Hopkins' first secretly taped recordings did not appear to provide the incriminating evidence that could truly bolster the prosecution, perjury, and obstruction of justice case against Barry Bonds. His second one, if admissible, might prove more powerful. Now, the government on Monday produced a 15-minute tape it contended would show Bonds' former personal assistant and business associate discussing the home runs King's use of steroids with an orthopedic surgeon, Arthur King, who operated on Bonds some 8 times. King severely damaged Hoskins' credibility Thursday when he said he had talked about the steroids once and not directly about Bonds using them. Hoskins had testified in the trial's first week and said that he had at least 50 such conversations. King also disputed Hoskins' assertion that the doctor had said the elbow injury that marred Bonds' 1999 season was caused by steroid use. King surgically repaired the elbow. The testimony by a noted medical specialist, albeit one who has twice been put on probation by the Medical Board of California, appeared to sway the momentum toward the defense in a trial which, you know, no side has really taken a clear-cut lead. Today's proceedings might determine whether Hoskins' second recording, which government officials say he found last weekend after previously being unable to locate it, reverses that shift. Now, the defense has raised concerns about the timing of the finding right after King's damaging testimony. Defense attorney Alan Ruby, who called for the tape to be authenticated, questioned its admissibility in court while referring to Hoskins' conduct as feckless. U.S. District Court Judge Susan Ilson will probably rule on whether the tape is admissible today when a transcript of its contents is available. Brad Simon, a former federal prosecutor who now does white-collar criminal defense in New York, said he liked the government's chances of getting the tape admitted. If they can authenticate the tape as a conversation and identify the voices, then regardless of how it came to be discovered, it's still prohibitive. Earlier in the trial, the prosecution had introduced a tape which made by Hoskins in which Bonds' former trainer Greg Anderson tells Hoskins about his strategy for injecting the slugger. But the poor quality of the recording and the defense's withering cross-examination of Hoskins, who appeared hazy about the details of his falling out with Bonds, left me impact as a witness. In addition, the defense pointed out Bonds had once accused Hoskins of stealing from him and forging his name on memorabilia. Nice. Keep that in mind here next time at a memorabilia show. And Ruby went as far as arguing that the government had dropped charges against Hoskins in exchange for his testimony. Then came King testimony, which unexpectedly boosted the defense. Monday's session apparently never got going because one of the jurors called him sick. However, the sudden presence of the second tape gave rise to what Simon called a lot of fireworks. It's still a little embarrassing for the government that they had to introduce the tape to discredit their own witness, Simon said. It's fodder for argument by the defense about how this is rather comical. But it's up to the jury to decide, notwithstanding the government's missteps, whether Ting perjured himself. As I said before, this is a very interesting case. A lot of fireworks, a lot of interesting stuff going back and forth. But I think the more interesting case is going to be the Roger Clemens case. That's coming up in July. As I said, I find it hard to believe that Bonds will get on the stand. His representation is too good. Even though Bonds is, you know, has a monster ego, I think Clemens' ego is even bigger. And his representation thus far has been not that good, in my opinion. He's been talking way too much. And I can almost guarantee you that Clemens will get on the stand, and that's probably just going to burn his house down, as they say. But this is kind of fun to watch. And as I said, the Clemens trial will be even more fun to watch. But that is in July. Moving forward. Yes.
Peter, I just wanted to, for 1 second, I think I got a George on the line. I don't know if he wants to come in or not to ask you a question, but I'm just going to refer him over to the chat room, okay? So go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
Nope. No problem. Okay. Anyway, UConn grabs the title as Butler falls short. UConn's Kemba Walker shouldered a tremendous load this season. The 6'1 All-American from Bronx, New York, steered a pretty young Connecticut team that started the season unranked all the way to the NCAA title game to face Butler on Monday night at Reliant Stadium. Walker looked pretty tired. He opened 0-for-5. Third-seeded Connecticut leaned on the fresh legs of freshman Lamb to snap out of their funk and win its third NCAA championship. Connecticut won the game 53-41, handing Butler its second consecutive loss in the title game and holding the Bulldogs 28-10 to a title game record low 19% shooting from the field. The game was absolutely unwatchable. I only watched a little bit of it anyway. I hate UConn. I was hoping they would lose, or maybe at the very least, maybe the team bus will crash or something. I was hoping for, you know, one or the other. This is the third title for Jim Calhoun. He's become the oldest coach to win a championship. He's had a tough season. Nearly a two-year investigation of recruitment violations. He's suspended next season for 3 games, and over the weekend, more allegations have surfaced. Albeit a lot of this stuff comes from his assistants, you know the violations. But I mean, he's the man in charge. His Webster Bank commercials are absolutely brutal. As I said, I hate UConn. They won the game. Good for them. But you know, Butler just tanked. And as I said just seconds ago, the game was absolutely unwatchable. Anytime a team shoots, 19%. I mean, just unwatchable basketball, really. And, too bad for Butler 2 years in a row. Hey, those are the breaks. But anyway, moving on. Baseball opened up last week. Fantastic. I was quite pleased. I watched my Yankees over the weekend. And I, of course, watched the Red Sox, who were swept in Texas, which is kind of nice. I picked Texas to win that division. They got a lot of good hitters on that team, as you could see over the weekend. I mean, they really pounded Red Sox pitching. And they have some good young pitching. They got some good young arms. You got to like that. A lot of heart on that team. And they hit a lot of home runs over the weekend, and Hamilton didn't hit any. So that's kind of, it's like, wow, it could have been even worse. Strange thing for the Red Sox, I noticed Terry Francona moved Carl Crawford in the lineup to bat seventh. I thought that was seemed like a little rushed to me to move him that far down the lineup. I'm not really sure. I mean, they just gave him a boatload of money. I know fans in Boston are always just super or hypercritical, whatever you want to say. Crawford always played well when he played against the Red Sox. And he played well against the Yankees as well. But, I mean, that's, when you have the other team's uniform on, Tampa Bay, less pressure, so on and so forth. But when you put on a Yankee or even a Red Sox uniform, the expectations are a lot higher. You have a lot of media in that town that are absolutely brutal, and the fans are also just really brutal. That's because most of the time they're drunk. But what are you going to do? Anyway, I just thought it was, kind of a bold move by Francona, and it didn't show like he had any faith in Crawford. I don't know, maybe he's trying to get him to relax more, moving him down to seventh in the lineup, but it seemed like a lack of faith in Crawford, and man, you just gave him all this money, let him hit second, suck it up, man, Speaking of guys that aren't hitting all that good, I would have to say Derek Jeter looks a little slow, a little old there. I'm hearing all kinds of excuses being made for him. To me, it's early, and again, it's only 3 games. It's just too bad that Jeter just looks a little slow, whereas the rest of the team kind of looks fantastic. I was happy to see Mark Teixeira get off to a big weekend. Guys hit a lot of home runs. A-Rod looks super fresh. Posada looks happier, at least content, and is his role as a DH. The bullpen has really looked quite sharp. You got to like what you're seeing out of the bullpen. That Soriano is just what the doctor ordered, as shown in yesterday's game. And Jabba Chamberlain, although he's put on a little weight, looks a little tougher, looks a little meaner, looks like he's throwing downhill a little bit better. Chamberlain came in, pitched the seventh, looked real sharp. Soriano came in and pitched the eighth, and Mo just did his thing. But to have a guy like Soriano come in the eighth, I mean, Soriano, former closer from the Rays. I mean, you got a former closer setting up, you know, best closer of all time. I mean, you just can't go wrong. Yankees bullpen is very strong. And, you know, sure, people have complained about the depth of the starters. But when you only got to go six innings, I mean, how great of a starter do you have to be just to go six or five and two-thirds or five and a third? I just don't see the Yankees having that many problems as people, you know, had diagnosed earlier in the season. Granted, it would be great, and I'm quite sure that they're going to they're going to sign somebody come the break, or they're going to trade for somebody. They're going to make a move. That's definitely going to happen. They're laying in the weeds. I like the whole attitude that Brian Cashman has put out there. Oh, the Red Sox are better than us. You know, they're favored to win. The Yankees are kind of like the sleeping giant who's going to get woke up at midseason when they throw another frontline pitcher into the rotation. And I think they're going to give the Red Sox quite a run for the money because, to me, the Yankee lineup is better. Although I did find something quite interesting. There was a little back and forth between the Mets and the Yankees about one of the relievers that the Yankees signed over the summer, Pedro Feliciano. Now, the ailing Yankees reliever did not appreciate the comments made by his former pitching coach, Dan Worthen, over the weekend, and he's looking to exact a little bit of revenge. Now, in response to Yankees general manager Brian Cashman saying the Mets abused Feliciano, Worthen said that the Mets did not re-sign Feliciano this winter because of how much they had used him. Now, that's not right when he said, "That's why we let him go," said Feliciano, who was on the 15-day disabled list with a sore shoulder. I read that, and it hurts because I like Dan. Feliciano then pointed to May 20th when the Mets come to Yankee Stadium. "I will show him the Subway Series," Feliciano said. "When I strike out Ike Davis and I jump on the mound pointing his finger as if Worthen was in front of him, I'll say, that's for you." This drama began Saturday when Cashman called the Mets using Feliciano a major league record 266 times in the last three seasons, an abusive pattern. Now, mind you, to me it seems like Cashman has a little bit of buyer's remorse. Cashman's a little bit out of shape that, you know, Feliciano's right on the disabled list, kind of where he almost thought he would be because he was used so much by the Mets. Anyway, and that's when Worthen fired back, saying the Mets chose not to bring Feliciano back this year because of how much mileage there was on his arm. He said, "That was part of the reason we decided not to resign him," Worthen said, "because we knew we had used him 270-something times in the last 3 years." Now, Feliciano said he never felt abused by the Mets, but he did question why they left him in some games to face right-handed batters. His bigger issue, however, was with Worthen. "I will come back from this injury," said Feliciano, who is scheduled to play catch later this week. "I'll be telling him, and I feel there's a lot of Feliciano to go." He said, "I would blow up this year. They didn't want to sign me because I will blow up. It hurts." Feliciano experienced arm trouble during spring training and has not pitched in a game since March 9th. The Yankees shut him down. The Yankees signed the 34-year-old to a two-year, $8 million deal with an option for 2013 this winter, after he, was 8 years with the Mets. He said the reason he jumped from Queens to the Bronx was the length of the deal the Yankee offered. The Mets did offer him a one-year deal, and that, but the reason, he signed with the Yankees, obviously, was because, they offered him a multi-year deal with a little bit of more money. Cashman said the Yankees were concerned about how much Feliciano had pitched, but there are limited options on the left-handed pitching market. As you know, the Yankees only have one other left-handed pitcher, and that's Boone Logan. Boone Logan, who throws really hard, but sometimes is a little bit erratic when it comes to the strike zone. So I don't blame the Yankees for signing Feliciano. He pitched in New York. Not a lot of guys can pitch in New York. He does have a lot of mileage. It's one of those signings, you don't live or die with whether Feliciano makes it. But, it would be nice if the guy has a good year. According to Feliciano, he wants to pitch and he always wants to be on the mound. That would be nice if we could just get him on the disabled list and get him into a game and we can see what's happening. So that bears a little watching. I think Jeter bears a little bit of watching. Be interesting to see, if he gets out of the gate a little bit quicker than he has. He certainly, as I said, looks a little bit slower. But, hey, it's early. It's only three games. But, when it comes to the Yankees, every game, there's 162 games in a season. But every game is like a one-game season for the Yankees, you know? It's like 162 seasons, and it's crazy. But that's just how it is. Every game is, you know, analyzed, and every at-bat is just scrutinized. But, you know, when it comes to Derek Jeter, I mean, he's the face of the franchise. And, I mean, hey, if you want to get all the accolades, you know, from back in the day, which you were getting, I mean, you got to put up with some of this stuff, too. I just, you know, I know Jeter is a little bit hard-headed, and I'm sure he's got a little bit of ego. I mean, who wouldn't? You know, he's got a lot of accomplishments, and I certainly tip my cap to him. I love Derek Jeter. It's going to be interesting to, you know, wait and see what happens. You know, if he pitches a little better. I mean, I'm sorry, if he hits a little better and he feels a little better. He just doesn't look crisp. But hey, it's only been 3 games, so let's just wait and see. But as I said, it was great to see Mark Teixeira get some big hits over the weekend. The guy is, you know, people can give him a hard time about his slow starts, and now he's off to a quick start. So that. Good for him. You got to like that. And again, as I said, A-Rod is looking real sharp. I think he's going to have an MVP season. Would not surprise me. And you can definitely quote me on that. Okay. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, my boy Peanut, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, especially my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Let's get some warm weather and enjoy the week.
Hey, before you hang up, I just want to see if George has a question for you. Hang on.
All right. I'm not sure if I have a good answer, but let's see.
I don't know either, but I'm trying to get him.
It's muted.
Hey, George, are you with us?
Yeah, I've been listening to you and the New York Yankees. Now this is new season, and, you know, I'm waiting to... I'm waiting to get my lips wet. I'm
sure.
Ready for the new season. Yeah, we'll see how this year turns out.
Well, yeah,
did you want to ask a question or?
It's gonna be a good one. It's gonna be a dogfight between the Yankees and the Red Sox. But I think with whomever the person that the Yankees pick up at the break is gonna be the difference maker.
There you go, my friend. Have a good week, Woody.
Thank you.
Good night, Woody. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Hang on 1 second here.
And I'll give you your music. But it's a complicated process to get it accomplished.
Whoa.
I agree. And it's a mess just thinking about it, you know. Gives me a headache.
For real. We're gonna go away for a quick break. You're more than welcome to stay on, and we got John Brennan coming up in about 10 minutes. So we're gonna go away for a quick little song break. If that's all right with you.
Oh,
you gonna hang on?
Yeah, I can't wait to listen to John. In the meanwhile, put the music on, and I'm gonna get myself a cup of coffee and come back and hear this out.
I promise you it's going to be a decent little song, too, so. Okay. We'll talk to you in a little while.
The music's over there.
Yeah, no, I know.
that. I wasn't as fond of that as he was. That
I guess it just kind of like moved you, moved me, kind of moved me. And while we're waiting for John to give us a caller, let's see if we get some more news or you want to play another tune.
Well, I think there was a few of those. There was a YouTube video that had a, keep going on that, that had an audio that I was kind of interested in.
I just briefly read this thing because
this really blew me out of the water. I hope this isn't true.
Yeah, North Carolina bill threatens to criminalize naturopaths, homeopaths, herbalists, midwives, aroma therapists as felons. Alternative health practitioners in North Carolina and their patients need your help to defeat a stealth bill that flew under the radar of most everyone in the natural health community. Senate Bill 31, which clarifies the penalties for the unauthorized practice of medicine, essentially criminalizes the practice of unlicensed forms of medicine, which include the work of many naturopaths, homeopaths, herbalists, aromatherapists, and even some midwives in the state. The bill was adopted by a Judiciary Committee in early March, and it recently passed the
North Carolina Senate.
Now the North Carolina House is set to vote on the bill tonight. And unless North Carolina Bev Perdue vetoes it, the practice of natural medicine for many in North Carolina may soon become a more severe criminal offense.
Isn't that ridiculous?
Yeah.
That's the American Medical Society lobbying against anybody.
And the pharmaceutical
anybody, company. And the pharmaceuticals.
Getting together and,
SB 31 states that anyone who practices medicine or surgery without having first been licensed and registered to do so will be guilty of a Class 1 felony. Class 1 felonies in North Carolina are the least severe kinds of felonies, but they do include things like burning crosses on private or public property and sexually exploiting children.
Oh, my God.
So if passed, SB 31 will essentially make those who practice alternative medicine without an official state-sanctioned license and permit criminals of the likes of sexual predators and cross-burners.
You can read the short bill for yourself at the following link. I'll pull that up in a minute, but it says, proponents of the bill say it fixes a loophole in the current law that classifies out-of-state practitioners who practice without a license as Class 1 felons. While in a state practitioner, in-state practitioners who practice without a license are only guilty of a Class 1 misdemeanor. All right? Now, that's weird. But what the bill actually appears to do is make it even harder for alternative practitioners who literally cannot be licensed in North Carolina because their work is not approved to practice at all. After all, who is going to be willing to provide alternative medical services for consenting patients when doing so makes them a felon?
SB 31 is just another way to target alternative practitioners and rein in the practice of medicine to only that which has been approved by the government overlords. And the timeline for defeating this bill is very short. Alternative practitioners in North Carolina and those who safely and successfully use their services need your help now to defeat this bill. Citizens for Healthcare Freedom, a nonprofit healthcare organization in North Carolina, say the bill is not in the interest of the citizens of North Carolina because its effects may many alternative practitioners who will be put out of business if it passes. The vast majority of these practitioners have been practicing for years and they have helped thousands of patients over the years using methods not officially sanctioned by state medical boards. They're going to vote on it. North Carolina House is so to vote on it tonight.
Yeah, vote on SB tonight, 7 p.m., so it's already done. And whether or not you live in North Carolina, this bill contributes to setting precedent of intolerance for natural and alternative medicine. So it is important to oppose it regardless of whether or not you live in North Carolina. You can reach the North Carolina House to oppose the bill by calling 919-733-7928. And you can reach Governor Bev Perdue's Raleigh office by calling 919-733-4240. And remember, when contacting government officials to express your thoughts, always be respectful but firm in your discourse. Clearly and succinctly express opposition to SB 31 on the grounds that it further erodes health freedom in North Carolina by criminalizing those who practice alternative medicine. Also urge support for the CHF Consumer Health Freedom Act, which establishes the freedom to practice alternative medicine without criminal penalty. And you can get this article on healthnaturalnews.com. All right?
So that's important.
And
I think John Brennan is with us. He's on the air. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Lila, and good evening, Leo. I'm just going to play a little bumper music, and I'll be with you in a moment.
Okay, go right ahead.
The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, and ransom our future and our children back strong.
And that is Mr. Steve Voss with We Must Take America Back, a song that was actually blacklisted by the Zionist control media, to put it quite bluntly. A really great song. If you want to go on YouTube, you can just YouTube Steve Voss, that's V-A-U-S. And really, really interesting words there about how we have lost this country through the criminal politicians in Washington and the United Nations, misleading us and turning us into a third world country in a, you know, very by gradualism. A little change here, a little change there, you don't notice. Everybody goes about their business and hopes somebody else is going to deal with it. A war here, a war there. You know, they spray us with the chemtrails. Nobody even notices. The news media, again, covers it all up. And
all meet at the bottom, as somebody said so eloquently.
Well, yeah, it sure does look like that would be the case. Yeah, they're leveling the playing field.
Yep.
I was going to talk a little bit about the chemtrail issue, but I kind of get a bit bored talking about it all the time, so I'm just going to go through some other environmental things that are happening, and I hope you haven't seen this story already. It does concern the nuclear fallout in Japan, but it's have you heard about the yellow rain that's been falling?
No,
somebody sent that over, but it wasn't really yellow rain. It looked like pollen.
Yeah, but that was an excuse.
Well, it looks like the pollen. No, I thought it looked exactly like the pollen that we see here in the springtime.
Except for it finished snowing over there.
Yeah.
Remember the cold weather?
What do you have on?
Yeah, well, go ahead, John. No, go ahead. I was just saying that I saw it, explain it, please.
Well, anyways, basically, while the Japanese government continues to say that the yellow rain seen in Japan is simply pollen, many of the people there seem to think it's something similar to what happened in the Chernobyl disaster, because they had a similar occurrence. And that's the interesting thing. There was a similarity there. Almost on cue, the Japanese Meteorological Agency confirmed the rain, of course, to be pollen after receiving hundreds of calls from concerned citizens. Now, the yellow rain seen Wednesday in the Kantango region surrounding Tokyo was caused by pollen, allegedly now, not radioactive materials, as many residents had worried, the Japan Meteorological Agency said Thursday. And this was reported in the Japan Times. That's right. According to these so-called experts, enough pollen to cause hundreds to report their findings rained down on Tokyo at the same time as the devastating nuclear disaster has released high levels of radiation
at least 20 kilometers from the nuclear plant. This explanation has reminded many of the yellow rain that hit after the Chernobyl disaster. Similar to the explanation in Japan, government officials claimed back then that the yellow radioactive rain that fell in Gomel, Belarus, was merely pollen and nothing to worry about. We now know that that was a bold-faced lie. Women and children actually played in those puddles of rain after the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl. We all jumped in puddles with the yellow stuff. You don't see it. It is in the air, and it doesn't materialize. But when you see the yellow dust, you see radiation, Antonina Sergeyev says. The accident was originally caused by a small testing error that resulted in a chain reaction in which highly pressurized steam literally blew the top off a nuclear reactor. The result was the release of 100 more times radiation than the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, according to the United Nations brief on Chernobyl. Among the unstable elements released were iodine-131, cesium-137, strontium-90, plutonium-239, and scientists say that exposure to such elements, especially in high doses, impairs critical cellular functions and damages DNA. When the elements first reached Sergeyev 20 years ago, they came in the form of yellow rain. It was not long after that residents in her hometown knew that it wasn't simply pollen, which is what the government officials assured them, she said. So, whether or not the yellow rain now falling on Japan is 100% radioactive remains to be seen. With that being said, history does repeat itself, and the way that Japan has covered up this disaster and used the exact same excuses as the ones used in Chernobyl indicates that we may be facing a much bigger disaster than Japanese officials are willing to admit. And again, they don't want to create panic in societies, which is why they would put out such reports, I suppose. Let me see.
I was going to mention that there was a report about rainwater in California that measured 181 times the acceptable limit for drinking water. All right, and that's just recently. That was just yesterday. Berkeley, California, 181 times the acceptable limit for drinking water.
Is that radiation or what it
means? Radiation, yeah. Radiation.
Wow.
Okay, so, go ahead, John. I'm sorry, I just brought
that up. I remember, was it last week we were talking about, whether they had deliberately caused something like this as a depopulation. You seemed kind of in disagreement that you don't think that they would actually do something deliberately using the, tectonic plate altering weapons, using the HARP technology.
Although I just saw something tonight that confirmed that to me, that you might have been right. And it was an article I saw on it just tonight. I was just looking at it. Let me bring it back up.
You have something more on that, John?
Yeah. What do you have?
It's on a during the course of that conversation that we had, I mentioned that the technology available and the medicines available are probably 100 years ahead for those who are in the elite. The people, the top leaders of the country, all the president's guys, and I'm talking worldwide. I'm not, in the Russian, presidency, all of the elite groups, the Saudi Arabian, the elite, not the guy in the street, not you or me, I assure you. They have access to the life extension technologies, which will incorporate microchips and cybernetics. Amongst other things. And I have two different articles here. I'm really not sure. One is about microchip implants, and then there's another one here. I'll go to this one first. Scientists have confirmed now that they I had to bring up the wrong article. They've got a genetically altered human. It sounds funny at first until you start to delve into this subject, but I've read a lot on this over the years. I just thought I'd bring this article to your attention. In the January and February 2004 issue of Mother Jones, a guy called Mark Dowie, he recounts how a Dr. Stuart Newman decided to test the willingness of the United States Patent Office. Newman applied for a patent to create a chimera, a monster, like a Frankenstein, I guess, if you will. The application was turned down. Newman pushed his claim just to see how far he could go, and the patent office remained firm. Newman wanted to raise awareness of what some genetic scientists were willing to do and how wrong it would be to allow it. Dowie writes, Newman's patent application is for an intriguing biotechnological contrivance called a chimera. According to Greek mythology, a chimera was a part lion, part goat, part serpent creature that terrorized Lycia until it was slain by the hero Bellerophon. If biotech continues to run amok, warns Newman, such inventions of legend and allergy could actually be invented. And I'm just going to ad lib here. A lot of people have said that a lot of the myths that were given, are they really mythological? Or where is this second time round for our whole technology, given that they can't still tell us how the pyramids were built? All right, go ahead.
Yeah, good point, John. I was just listening. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm delving off here a little bit, but the people have, the modern stone cutters who've got these metal gauges have measured parts of the pyramids and the Giza monument, and they've seen that it had to be cut with machines. Interesting video, if you want to look it up, is called The Technologies of the Gods. That's one that you can look at to see what I mean. They obviously had advanced technology back then, and something happened, and we've been left in the dark ever since. So maybe all of this is second time round, and including perhaps the fact that they went way ahead of where we're going now to do this merging of humans and animals. Anyway, I get back to this here. Newman sought to patent chimeric embryos and animals containing human cells, taken to its most extreme but not necessarily impossible end. The technology could be used to manufacture soldiers with armadillo-like shielding, quasi-human astronauts engineered for long-range space travel, and altered primates with enough cognitive ability to ride a bus, follow basic instructions, pick crops in 119 degrees heat, or descend into a mine shaft without worrying their silly little heads about inalienable human rights and the resulting laws and customs that demand safe working conditions. Well, 3 years earlier, as reported in the Telegraph, that was September 27, 2001, boys' DNA implanted in rabbit eggs. This is written by Roger Highfield. The scientists had begun to walk down that road. The scientists in China have inserted a boy's DNA into empty rabbit eggs and grown hybrid embryos, it was reported. A team at the Sun Yat-sen University of Medical Sciences are trying to overcome a practical limitation. Today's issue of Nature Reports reports about Dr. Chen Xing at Sun Yat-sen in some of the 100 or so successful transfers to the rabbit egg. Stripped of chromosomes, an embryo developed to the Morula stage. The compact ball of cells then forms after 3 days of development. For stem cells to be isolated, the embryos must be coaxed into developing further. In Britain, the government plans to ban the creation of hybrids. Also in 2001, there was another ambitious experiment, BBC Online. This was May 4, 2001. Scientists have confirmed that the first genetically altered humans have been born and are healthy. Up to 30 such children have been born, 15 of them as a result of one experimental program at a U.S. laboratory. Genetic fingerprint tests on 2 1-year-old children confirm that they contain a small quantity of additional genes not inherited from either parent. The additional genes were taken from a healthy donor and used to overcome their mother's infertility problems. The additional genes that the children carry have altered their germline or their collection of genes that they will pass on to their offspring. Note, this means the new abnormal configuration of genes will spread out into the general population over time with unknown effects, just similar to the corn, the genetically altered corn. They don't know what will happen. Writing in the journal Human Reproduction, researchers say that this is the first case of human germline genetic modification resulting in normal, healthy children, or so-called normal, healthy children. The superhighway into the genetically designed future isn't just a science fiction fantasy. Stones on that highway have already been laid down. And that's basically as much as I can read on that one for you. It's interesting where all this is going. And a lot of this stuff is very hard to find. If you print phrases like hybrid humans in, a lot of the stuff's missing off the internet.
Oh, really?
I brought up articles and go back, they're gone. I just
I was going to ask you. George is on the other line. He's been listening in for a big part of the night.
Oh, good.
He was very interested to hear your segment. I was wondering if you might want him to. You didn't want to talk?
No, he just said he was going to listen.
Oh, that's all he said? Okay, I didn't know. You know, I have something here, John. We were talking about that pollen.
Yes.
Greenpeace came out with something that says Japan's nuclear disasters, three separate Chernobyl level 7 incidences.
Right?
Says a recent Greenpeace study based on data from French and Austrian governments showed that by March 23rd, so much radiation had already been released from Fukushima that the crisis already equates to three Chernobyl INES level 7 incidents. Okay? Imagine that.
Yeah, that it is extreme. I mean, we really don't know what the results of this are going to be 10 years from now.
It's quite scary. And they're dumping all that radiation into the oceans.
Yeah, and I was looking at this other thing that had the potential for April 6th Fukushima fallout forecast, and it showed the entire. It's a little YouTube video, but it showed this purple. It shows the sweeping of the
radiation
over the United States and into Europe.
Western Europe.
Right. Yeah. And how it affected the whole world. And especially up around the north. It swept up around the North Pole as well and then down into the Atlantic, the Greenland, all through Greenland.
It's in the jet stream, in other words. So it's spreading worldwide. That circulates the entire planet.
That's exactly what it's going around. And I don't know if there's any sound to this thing. It's only
20
seconds.
I'm actually very glad I'm working indoors because I worked as a landscaper outside most of my life. And with the recent snow, the last snowstorm, which was pretty late in the year for us, and the rain and all that, I'm really glad that stuff isn't landing on me, just in case. I don't have a Geiger counter. I do have a friend that's got one down in Bristol, and I'm curious to see if he's taken any readings. I'll give you some reports on that if I can get a hold of them.
Yeah, no, it's just amazing to know that that so much of that crap has come over, has already come to the United States, you know.
Ireland was on the headlines of the Irish Independent that there was a radioactive cloud going over the country, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's there, all right.
Something's going to happen to somebody getting cancer or deformities of next generation, I imagine.
Yeah, in fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to email this over to you anyway. I'll email it over to you.
So you can take a look at it.
Yeah, pretty bizarre.
It's really scary, though, and you just don't see the government really stepping up or the mainstream media stepping up and talking about it. It's like, all of a sudden there's not too much on the news about Fukushima anymore.
Well, of course, it's a great distraction from the Gulf BP oil disaster. And I just to mention, I think, isn't it almost a year to the day we're at that 20th of April was the time, or 19th?
Oh, here's a good one. This one will interest you, John. Lila heard it on the. Where did you see that anyway? About the 4444.
Oh, I don't know where I think I read it on this. It was interesting. Obama gave his re-announcement for his election
speech. Right.
He did it on April 4th, the fourth month, the fourth day. He's the 44th president, and it's all
in 2011. Which is four. Numerically, is it four?
You're into that numerology thing, and we just thought we'd mention
4444 right across the board. What do you think he's talking? What do you think he's trying to do there?
I'd have to sit back and think about it and analyze it. Perhaps with Andy Sewell, he's really good at that. So I don't know. I know that you're right. These guys are really into numerology. It's sort of a language. Basically,
right,
it is. It means something to them.
But talk it over with Andy and see what he thinks about that.
Yeah, he's got a lot more. I used to pay a lot more attention to numerology, but it gets kind of time consuming. And then when I had my friend Andy, he's very well able to decipher that. Sometimes it is nothing, and they just do it just to kind of make people look like conspiracy theorists. But historically, there is definitely things that happen on certain days every single year. They're satanic holidays sometimes.
Right.
I have to those from David Icke's books, and there's just so many days there. In fact, I'm reaching for a book.
But I don't think it could be a coincidence.
I'd be interested to hear what George has to say on that. What do you think?
Sure, put George on.
Would you mind? Yeah. Hang on a second.
Hello.
Hey, George. How you doing?
George, good evening.
I've been listening to everything.
What do you think, George? What do you think of the 4444 stuff?
I don't know. It's interesting. It really is.
Oh, well, okay.
I don't know. You know, it's like...
Well, you knew what fives meant, and you knew we talked about that. So, but we did a whole show on the number five. But I was wondering about the number four.
I'll give you an example of some of the.
Well, it's a completing number, but I don't know. I don't know if I see it that way. You know, it's just coincidence. But you know, it could be something recent. You know, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think it's coincidence at all.
No, because you look at...
Well, no, I don't think it's coincidence. I'm sure there's a purpose for it.
And no, you look at 777, which was the London bomb, 911, and now there were some others. What were the other ones, John? There was a few others.
Well, you have April 19th. It was the people in... They burned down the Waco... the Branch Davidians down in Waco.
Right,
And then it was also April 19th, 2 years later, the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City.
Well, you got to remember, 320 was when they went into, when they started the Iraq War.
That's right.
And 320, they bombed, they started a new one. They bombed Libya.
Yeah.
All right. Later, yeah.
You know, exactly. instead of speculating on what could be and so forth, I think it's interesting the way it's coming out right now. And you know, first of all, him announcing that you know he's going to be running, you know, for the next election. You know, it's like too early in a horse race. And in my perspective, you know, I don't spend too much time there because I only spend $2 on I put down to win. You know, I've been a loser for a number of years. But John, are you still there?
Yes, I am, George.
You came to my mind several times in the last couple of weeks here because I know you've been busy with understanding HAARP and you know these contrails and so forth.
Yeah.
And just this technology, but you know with Leo and myself and Lila on the Friday night show. Is taking a look at, you know, some of the repercussions coming from, you know, these Japanese nuclear reactors. And, you know, it's through the technology of the HAARP program that an answer came to how we could take care of this. And that deals with scalar wave technology and understanding the ELF waves and so forth. It's all scalar wave. But what you could do is using the scalar wave energy to cancel out the radiation.
George, yeah, listen, I look at 3 seconds. Good night, everybody. God bless. Okay, there you go. I just had to say good night because nobody, we lost our stream. All right? So we're gonna close it up. But
I'm sorry, Leo.
No, it's okay. I just saw the board, and I only had, 10 seconds left to say we're leaving. But, okay,
say good night to folks.
Yeah. So go ahead, George. I'm sorry.
John, are you still there?
Yes, sir, I am. Yes, go ahead, George.
Yeah, so, for me, I'm always trying to look, for a way out of this, how we could deal with it, because there is a real problem with that, the radioactive wave that's going to hit us, there's no doubt about it. But we've come a long ways since, World War II and some of the effects we had to deal with there. But I think it's understanding this new technology that we have, taking some of that heart technology and with different frequencies of energies and actually cancel out any effects that it has. But that is part of understanding this ELF realm of technology. But I think we are at a point now where we have that technology that we can protect ourselves from the last time this happened, which is going back about 9772 BC on the last great catastrophe that happened then. John, I think I could see some sunlight between the clouds, and it does look kind of gloomy, and this yellow rain scares the hell out of me. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we may have to see some of the effects around the world before we take hold of it and deal with it. And I think this time around, we'll have the medicine if we need it, but I think mentally we could turn this thing around by our own minds and by the technology that we have. And there's another remedy that could be used, which is understanding the properties of water with Moto, saying that consciousness, by focusing on water, we can change the molecular structure of that water. And the water is the living water of life, that it flows through anything and everything. And it's through this water that we can contact and alter, if you'd want to call it that, the different atoms and different connections that, nuclear energy has to, our physics and our properties. So
I think that we can follow up on that on another night. We've been on for 2 hours here, but I want to thank you both guys for being on and hanging with us. And John, it was a good report. Thanks. And you got anything else to close out with, Johnny?
I just picked up the David Icke book here. There's a couple of dates. There's about 6 dates I'll give you why certain things might happen. The days you would mention there about the
444.
Writing on the 20th of March, I think it was.
Yeah.
That was it's the Minerva, the god of war.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I found an article. Maybe it's up on Rents.com. Just happened to see it last night. If you look up Minerva, the god of war, that's one of the times. That's one of the reasons.
Also, the spring solstice is right there too.
Yeah, it's an offering of bloodshed to the goddess Minerva.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. Another one of the dates you'll often find out, there are satanic dates, basically. One of the dates is February 1st and 2nd. That's Candlemas. March 21st, 22nd is the spring equinox. And a lot of these satanic people will use those in evil ways. April 30th, May 1st, Walpurgis. June 21 is the summer solstice. You'll sometimes find strange events going on then. July 31st to August 1st, Lammas, the great Sabbath festival. December 22nd, of course, 21st, 22nd, winter solstice.
Solstice, right.
But if you could follow up and see if there's any significance to the four, that would be very interesting if you have to do that.
Okay, I'll have a talk with Andy and see what he can come up with on that.
Okay, that would be great. And thanks so much for being with us. And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Yeah.
All right.
Before we
and good night, George, and good night, folks.
Good night.
Have a good night, everybody, and please join us tomorrow night and Wednesday, Thursday nights, right here.
And every other Friday.
And every other Friday, right here on Blog Talk Radio, starting at 8 o'clock tomorrow night. And have a pleasant evening.